Hello, I'm Matthew Bannister. Thank you for downloading this episode of Last Word from BBC Radio 4. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. On Last Word this week, Stan Kelly Bootle, the Liverpudlian who co-wrote this song.
I wish I was back in Liverpool, Liverpool town where I was born. There is no trees, no scented breeze, no fields of waving corn.
We'll have more of Stan's music later. Also this week, Bev Evans, the Welsh teacher whose resources for children with special educational needs are used all over the world. The Radio 3 broadcaster and composer Anthony Hopkins and the former president of the National Farmers Union, Sir Ben Gill. But first... Professor Colin Pillinger was the space scientist who led the Beagle 2 mission to investigate life on Mars. His mutton chop whiskers, long grey hair and West Country accent made him look and sound more like a prog rock guitarist or a farmer than a scientist. And indeed, he lived on a 30-acre dairy farm outside Cambridge. But his passion was space. It all started when he was a boy in Bristol, devouring the comic book adventures of Dan Dare and the Mekon. This early enthusiasm led to an eminent academic career, which gained him fellowships of the Royal Astronomical Society, the Royal Society, and the Royal Geographical Society. But the project which brought him to wider public attention was the attempt to land an unmanned British spacecraft on Mars. The Beagle 2 mission ended in failure on Christmas Day 2003, when Colin had to admit that his team had lost contact with the craft. The impressionist John Culshaw is a keen amateur astronomer and met Colin Pillinger on the TV programme The Sky at Night.
I just loved his no-nonsense tenacity and the way that he was kind of grumpy with the way that if you ever wanted to get anything done in science, you had all this bureaucracy to go through and he just wanted to roll up his sleeves and get on with it, the shortest route to get the thing done.
We're the only country in the world that would send a man to climb the highest mountain with brown boots and a tweed suit on, so I have every faith in British ingenuity to get Beagle 2 on Mars.
And I loved that attitude about him, and I think if there was more scientists with that kind of attitude, then maybe by now we'd have more lunar bases and Mars bases. I think you need that kind of attitude, that impatience, and he had it beautifully.
The theoretical physicist Dr. Paul Abel is one of the presenters of The Sky at Night.
What he was hoping to find was some evidence that Mars had harboured life. Because if Mars has harboured life in its distant past, then the chances of finding life out there in the universe increases exponentially. And I think the whole idea that there was once life on Mars and maybe evidence of it below the soil was something that he found compelling. And that's really what Beagle 2 was looking for. It was looking for life in the distant past.
I cannot believe that life on Earth is unique. The element carbon, which makes up life, is in fact the fourth most abundant element in the universe. Hydrogen is the most abundant element. Oxygen is the third most abundant element. So water is the most abundant compound. So you've got your water, you've got the element in which you build compounds for life. Can't believe it hasn't happened somewhere else. I think it would be incredibly arrogant of us to believe that we're the pinnacle of evolution.
He was so shockingly recognisable, wasn't he, with the sideburns and the sort of West Country accent. But he was very, very good at communicating science. I think I've often thought about the secret of communicating science isn't to bamboozle people with big words and technical concepts. It's to get the ideas across as efficiently as possible. And I think Colin was definitely up there, able to do that quite quickly, very skillfully, actually. He went out of his way to popularise it. The call sign where he got the band Blur to do, and the test card as well for the spacecraft, he got that painted by Damien Hirst. So he was very good at getting influential people involved with his projects.
Alex James is the bass player with Blur.
I went to his laboratory and he pulled a little rock out of his pocket and he said, "Do you know what this is?" and it just looked like a pebble. He said, it's a bit of Mars. And like, I was instantly spellbound. He was just like so instantly compelling and engaging, really had the X factor all right.
British scientists involved in the Beagle mission to Mars have resumed efforts to try to make contact with the missing space probe. Attempts this morning to communicate with the craft...
It's like sending somebody a love letter. You know they've got it and you're waiting for their response. We are out there. We're waiting for a response. We're trying, Beagle. Please bark.
Had this Beagle spacecraft have worked, it would have delivered some very novel, very exciting science. And I think all of us really felt for him that Christmas morning when contact was lost. It departed from Mars from orbit and was never heard of again. I think we all felt just as sorry for him as well as for the loss of the mission.
We all knew that we were on a high-risk strategy, but the goal was big enough to merit the risk. Every generation needs its Gothic cathedrals. We shouldn't be doing things that everybody else has done already. We have to do something which is adventurous and risky.
How do you think he coped with that failure?
He was probably very frustrated by it, but he was able to deal with that very well. Once again, his no-nonsense attitude of just rolling his sleeves up and getting on to the next thing got him through that. And I think he was very, very proud of it.
People gave willingly to work on Beagle because they were inspired by it. And it inspired the whole nation such that there were people sitting on the edge of their seats on Christmas morning. There were kids that got up and said, not where are my presents, that's Beagle landed.
You just looked at this Beagle 2 lander and you think that in the future, when astronauts are on Mars, they're going to lift it up somewhere, put it somewhere, and they'll fix it. And it will work. And there'll be something very, very satisfying about that.
In memory of Colin.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
John Culshaw on Professor Colin Pillinger, who's died aged 70. Now, Anthony Hopkins was the composer and conductor who for more than 30 years enthralled listeners to Radio 3 with his programme Talking About Music. He dissected compositions, illustrating his points by playing extracts on the piano or using recordings. Anthony was also a poet and wrote many books about music. He was grateful to his father, who was a keen amateur pianist, for passing on his musical talents, even though he died when Anthony was just 4 years old. We spoke to Anthony's friend and musical collaborator, John Turner.
When I was a child, I used to go out every Saturday for a run with my parents. We either used to go to Llandudno or the Wirral. And the highlight was actually coming back in the car and switching on Anthony's programme. And the insights on it were absolutely amazing. He could discuss music in the most wonderful way and force you to see things that you'd never seen before.
I think it's only fair at this stage to remind you that composers as great as Bach and Handel had no hesitation in lifting material from their contemporaries or predecessors. If imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, such petty thefts can be regarded as compliments. Moreover, Poulenc will even pinch from himself on occasion. I suppose his best-known piano piece is the little piece of nonsense that goes like this.
He was small, his legs were short, and he always said he couldn't really play the organ because his legs were so short, and when he went up to the top of the keyboard or the bottom of the keyboard, he fell off. He had a remarkable sense of humour. Every letter that he sent to me was signed by another name. It either said, "Yours sincerely, Ludwig," or "Wolfgang," or "Johann Sebastian."
They began with Opus 127, wafting us all to heaven, each conjuring from his instrument such perfect tones that one felt that Beethoven's very bones would respond and warm in their grave. What's more, they possessed an intuitive comprehension of each other's intention, four minds that seemed in a way to behave as if they were one. When it was done, we clapped till our hands were sore, demanding more. Again they smiled that strangely unanimous smile. It was just while they were settling down for Bartok's third that I heard a voice in my ear, my friend the well-informed Klutz. "What a pity," he said, "that they hate each other's guts."
He never thought he was a very good composer. He always said he was a second-rate one. Well, he might have been second string, but on the other hand, his music is delightful, it's tuneful, and often copies other people. Well, so what? It's absolutely delightful to listen to. He thought his best piece was the Viola Sonata, which is on the disc we did for his 90th birthday. A lovely piece. And I think he's the only composer who's written an obligatory part for the page-turner. In the slow movement, the page-turner has to play very carefully some low notes. The piece can't do without them. Anthony would be most proud of the BBC recordings that he did over so many years, and also of his books. And I think latterly he came to realise that his music was actually rather better than he thought in his early days, and he got so much pleasure from people actually listening to it.
Music composed by Anthony Hopkins, who's died aged 93. Now, Bev Evans was the Welsh teacher who produced resources for children with special educational needs and offered them free on the internet. A project which started on her kitchen table in a remote part of North Wales was eventually used by people all over the world. Her work was picked up by the Times Educational Supplement, and she was taken on as a consultant to their digital publishing arm. The editor of the TES is Anna Mroz.
We discovered that her resources were being downloaded all over the world by lots and lots of different people in different countries.
Hi, I'm Bev Evans, and today I'm going to show you 15 ways to use PowerPoint in your classroom. I get a little fed up sometimes with people saying that PowerPoint's old-fashioned, not relevant, not useful.
Currently, she's been downloaded over 5 million times. Fiji, Mongolia, the United Arab Emirates, Australia, America, just everywhere.
You might have a child in your class that struggles with text, and yet you still want them to record their work and display it nicely and maybe make a presentation. On PowerPoint, if you go to the Insert menu and go to Sound, you can record sound directly onto the PowerPoint slide.
Between them, Bev and her husband Paul have six children, including their son Matthew, who has learning difficulties and cerebral palsy. I asked Paul how they rose to the challenge of bringing him up.
It just came naturally, to be honest. Matthew's grown up into quite an admirable young man.
And Bev got a job as a dinner lady, I think, at a local school, didn't she?
That's right. Well, because there were so many children involved, and Matthew with his difficulties, it was the perfect job, really.
She went on to become a teaching assistant, and while she was a teaching assistant, I think she was working with a girl with learning disabilities.
That's right, a little girl who had no speech at all and problems with mobility.
And was that the inspiration for her website?
It was, really. There was a lot of need to adapt work that was happening in the classroom.
I've got a little version here of the Three Billy Goats Gruff that I've recorded myself. Once upon a time, there was not one, not two, but three Billy Goats Gruff. Okay, so you get the idea.
She started looking on the internet to see what was available to help her meet those needs, and really found very little or nothing at all.
Now, the troll still sounds like me, and I want to change it, so I'm going to generate that with an effect. And now my troll sounds like this.
Who goes trip-trap, trip-trap over my bridge?
So she started developing her resources for this little girl. From there, she decided to share and to develop her own website with that purpose in mind.
This bit here should be the baby Billy Goat Gruff speaking. Let me just check. It is I, baby Billy Goat Gruff. And I want that to be much higher and much cuter sounding, so I'm going to do the same thing.
Is I, baby Billy Goat Gruff.
So she could see that there would be lots of other people, parents perhaps of children with disabilities or teachers who would want the resources.
That's right. It doesn't just stop at people with difficulties. Anybody wanting to learn English or as a second language, you've got to start somewhere.
She used to get contacted by people all over the world wanting to translate her resources for her to help them, because they wanted to adapt them to whatever they were doing, and she would help them, and they would come to her through social media. They'd come to her through email, through the site, and she always had time to help all of them. It's an incredible woman.
What do you think drove her, Paul? What do you think motivated her to be somebody who gave so much?
She just thrived on being that helpful person. She really did. It annoyed me a little because she'd be working all day. She'd come home and she'd be on the computer and developing resources till maybe 10 or 11 o'clock at night. and I couldn't see the point in it until she started getting all these awards.
And then you saw it?
And then I saw it, and it just blew me away. It was unbelievable.
There are people in this world who, when they walk into a room, they can leave it without leaving a trace. When Bev came into a room, she really lit it up, and in rainbow colours. That wasn't only because of her personality. She was terribly joyful, but she would wear really mad outfits. You never knew what colour her hair was going to be the next time you saw her. It was always a total surprise. You never knew what style it was going to be. And her personality was just huge. She was always happy.
She was quite an unusual dresser, which emphasised the glow that came from here. Wherever she was in life, if she walked into her room, she would improve something. She would brighten the place.
Hopefully, with a bit of practice, your children will be able to produce something like this.
One Snowy Night by Nick Butterworth. It's cold in the park in the winter. With
thanks
two
for watching.
Pairs of socks.
Bye.
But Percy the Park.
The work of Bev Evans, who's died aged 46. Now, Sir Ben Gill was the president of the National Farmers Union. He was closely involved in two of the industry's biggest crises. When BSE, or mad cow disease, devastated British beef, he led efforts to reassure the public of its safety. And when foot and mouth disease struck just a few years later, he advocated the mass slaughter of animals as the only effective way to stop the disease spreading. We spoke to the presenter of Farming Today, Anna Hill.
He was very forthright. He was a big man. He was tall. And very imposing, you know, and he had a presence.
Vaccines are not on the agenda. They never have been in this country. They would only mask the disease. They do not lead to the eradication of it. We need to have...
He did come from a farming background. He trained as a farmer. He went to Cambridge, studied agriculture. He was out in Africa. He farmed out there. His family had a farm in Yorkshire, so he knew on the ground about farming.
One of the things that has become quite clear in the last 20 years is that the productivity of horticulture and food production has stalled in many sectors, and there is a need to redress.
He had to become the face of farming to the media, and I don't think any NFU president had to do that before. He had to stand up in front of cameras and by the microphone and be interviewed continuously because of these crises. And he stepped up to the plate.
Rights of way need to be closed now.
I believe, regrettably, rights of way do need to be closed. I've talked about that to the Minister and I've talked to the Prime Minister.
Lord Currie is a former chairman of the Meat and Livestock Commission.
We had food scare after food scare. Consumer confidence was at an all-time low. And BSE was probably the worst of those food scares.
Good afternoon. MPs are to carry out an urgent investigation into mad cow disease. They want to make sure the government's right, saying it's safe to eat beef.
Members were demanding action. So Ben was deeply into defending the industry on the basis of current scientific knowledge and trying to reassure members of the NFU that he and the team were doing everything possible to get the support of government, to find ways of compensating farmers who were suffering financially and of restoring consumer confidence. It was a massive communication challenge.
And then there was another equally massive, if not more massive, challenge in foot and mouth.
Indeed. And by the time we encountered and experienced the dreadful consequences of foot and mouth disease, Ben was NFU president, and he was without doubt leading the NFU and the farming sector throughout that foot and mouth disease crisis.
What about finally the animal welfare issue? How many animals will have to be destroyed, and is it absolutely necessary that they can be destroyed?
It is a major debilitating disease and the animals will suffer. We're looking at getting rid of it and saving the welfare of all the rest of the national herd and flock, and that is, slaughter is the best way.
It brought the country to a standstill. He was absolutely in the front line, having daily meetings with ministers and the government's chief vet, and he took a very prominent position of leadership during that crisis.
Prince Charles says foot and mouth could lead farmers to suicide.
Precautions didn't prevent foot and mouth finding its way onto Dartmoor. A case was
terrible publicity for farming, to have those images of cattle and sheep being slaughtered and people in white suits going through the countryside being closed off to the public because of disease.
Every farmer on the fells is adamant that we will not let our sheep off the fells go without a fight.
It was absolutely devastating. It really was. I have never heard farmers cry.
We cannot walk away from these lambs. We have to do everything we can because that's the way we've been brought up. And we can't stop.
Oh, sorry. Tim Bennett was working alongside Ben Gill at the NFU during the crisis.
We were taking phone calls from members non-stop, and some of those members had lost their livelihoods. Good friends were losing their animals. And, of course, they were ringing, expecting the instant solution as well. So it was a very traumatic time for the people who lost the animals. And Ben had to take that emotion for what it turned out for many months.
It did take its toll. It was a difficult period. He was clearly under enormous emotional pressure. He was the right man for that period in history because he was extremely robust. Having decided scientifically that this was the only route available, he defended it vigorously.
He enjoyed politics and he enjoyed the cut and thrust of debate, but at heart he was a farmer and he knew farmers really well. And all he wanted to do, I think, in his way, was to help farmers do the best they could.
Anna Hill on Sir Ben Gill, who's died aged 64. Now, there were many sides to the life of Stan Kelly Bootle. When he was born in Liverpool in 1929, he was called Stan Bootle. He worked in the early computer industry as the machines came out of the lab and into the mainstream. But as his alter ego Stan Kelly, he was also a folk singer of some renown. Later in life, he amalgamated his two names. Stan's friend Bill Leese told me about his early life.
Just a humble Liverpool background. His father was a plumber. He went to a local primary school in the Waverley part of South Liverpool. He managed to pass 11 plus and went to the Liverpool Institute School, which was probably one of the most academically minded state schools in Liverpool at that time.
And that set him up for getting a place at Cambridge, didn't it?
It did indeed. I mean, the whole ethos of the school really was one of getting working class kids into university and preferably Oxford or Cambridge. And Stan just ticked all the boxes. He got a place at Cambridge to read maths. He actually went up after his national service, took a first-class degree. He and one or two others were hand-picked to do the first ever postgraduate diploma in computing anywhere in the world. He certainly came into contact with Alan Turing, who, you know, is credited with the thought processes behind modern computing.
So Stan must have been a computer pioneer himself.
Absolutely.
And he became a successful entrepreneur.
He did indeed. He had a red and white open-top Porsche because he was, after all, a Liverpool fan to his fingertips. He was a streetwise scouser who just happened to have a first-class degree from Cambridge. And excellent company that he was. Underestimate him at your peril.
I've been over Snowdon, I've slept upon Croydon, I've camped by the Wainstones as well. I've sunbathed on Kinder, been burnt to a cinder, and many more things I can tell.
When he wasn't making money from his work in computers, Stan was singing folk songs, like this one from the acclaimed 1950s radio ballad about engine driver John Axton.
And sooner than part from the mountains, I think I would rather be there. I'm a rambler from Manchester way. I get all me pleasure, the
heart more. And am I right in thinking that he jammed with Paul Robeson?
So he told me, yes. He spent 30 years from the 70s up to the early 2000s in California. This probably was when he came into contact with Paul Robeson. And, of course, Tom Lehrer, who, again, had a similar background in that he had been a mathematician as well.
And he wrote a song, I think, for the Dubliners, didn't he?
It was with Leon Russellson, and he wrote, I wish I was back in Liverpool, dear old Liverpool town, where there ain't no trees, no scented trees, no fields of waving corn, etc., etc.
Liverpool town, where I was born, where there ain't no trees, no
scented breeze, no fields of waving corn. But there's lots of girls with peroxide curls and a black and tan flows free.
He also wrote a song for Cilla Black, another Liverpool anthem.
Yes.
Oh, you are a mucky kid, dirty as a dustbin lid. When he hears the things that you did, you'll get a belt from your dad.
Cilla Black recorded it. Judy Collins covered it in one of her mid-60s albums as well. And, you know, he would sing it himself at the drop of a hat as well, often being thrown out of pubs for it as well, because I was with them at the time.
If you're not asleep when the booze is closed, you'll get a belt from your dad. Liverpool Lullaby.
So what was it like to have a night out with Stan?
You never knew where you'd end up because he was so phenomenally learned. You could have a conversation which would start as the prospects of Liverpool at the match at the weekend, and you'd end up by sort of discussing the ins and outs of the pronunciation of modern Icelandic.
Right.
Stan was a self-taught linguist. He loved the foibles of the English language.
Way back in times immoral, lost in the mists of iniquity, when Jesus was playing fullback for Israel.
And he formed a relationship too with the late Fritz Spiegel, a writing relationship, I should be clear, to write these books, the Learn Yourself Scouse books.
Yeah, he and Fritz were almost twin souls. It's all slightly tongue-in-cheek, and it's full of what Stan used to call malapudlians, deliberate malapropisms. Sold lots of copies, still do. If I go into any tourist office in Liverpool now, you will still find Learn Yourself Scouse.
Am I right in thinking that he was also Kevin Keegan's agent?
He worked with several of the footballers in Liverpool in the early 70s. He got them into the recording studio, really pushing them as being simply more than footballers, but sort of entertainers as well.
And it looks like I'm falling all over again. It overheals.
It was just really one of the many, many strands to his character.
I was going to say, he sounds like a sort of multifaceted person.
He absolutely was. He was one of the most extraordinary people that I've ever known.
Memories of Stan Kelly Bootle, who's died aged 84. This week you also heard last words on the president of the National Farmers Union, Sir Ben Gill, the teacher Bev Evans, the broadcaster and composer Anthony Hopkins, and the space scientist Professor Colin Pillinger. Just a reminder that the programme's available as a podcast. You'll find us if you search online for BBC Last Word. That was a download of Last Word from BBC Radio 4.